If you're a woman and you're sick and tired of watching your hair get thinner and thinner, we're about to challenge everything you think you know about hair loss, because we're going to send you a risk-free trial of a product with an FDA-approved ingredient clinically proven to help stop women's hair loss and regrow hair. It's called Keranique. Find out how you can try it risk-free when you call 1-800-641-9352 in the next 10 minutes. You're going to be amazed by what you see, because Keranique is formulated especially for women to help repair hair follicles, prevent premature hair loss, and regrow thicker, fuller hair. And it's sulfate-free, which means it's safe for color-treated hair. Ladies, it's finally your turn to be free from embarrassing hair loss. Call 1-800-641-9352 in the next 10 minutes and try Keranique before you buy it. But hurry, supplies are extremely limited. For your risk-free trial, call 1-800-641-9352. That number again is 1-800-641-9352.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio Show. My guest for this morning is Laurie Giles. Besides being an attorney, Laurie is also an author, a certified life redefining and transition coach, and a media personality. She specializes in helping women and men survive and flourish through life-altering situations and transitions. Laurie and I will be discussing about her life's journey, her book series titled What Now, and her unique, holistic, and synergistic approach to tackling life's sudden challenges. Good morning, Laurie. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Fantastic. Doing great. I really enjoyed reading your book. They are awesome workbooks in helping everyone prepare what I considered as the expected as well as the unexpected. So I really enjoyed that very much. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Wow, that's such a hard question. It definitely is thought-provoking for me. Well, you know, I grew up in a very traditional family in an upper middle class small town in Connecticut. My dad, a CPA, went off to work while my mom stayed home and took care of my brother and me, and she did the PTA thing and the Girl Scout thing. So, you know, in essence, we were the American dream family. Mom, dad, 2.5 kids, and the white picket fence. Well, except for we didn't have the half child, but we did have a dog and a cat. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have the white picket fence. But did I mention that we were the only black family in this upper middle class Connecticut suburb? Mm-hmm. So that was a little bit different. Growing up in the 60s, we moved there in the midst of the civil rights movement. So growing up in a town where you are the only minority, clearly in the neighborhood, definitely in the school, and in the town, very, very, very few. So it was a challenge, but it certainly was a good childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I went off to school in Massachusetts, then went to law school in New Jersey. I married for the first time between college and law school. And then as I was graduating from law school and taking the bar, I had my daughter. And, then I became a single mother 2 years after that. And so it was the two of us trying to hustle and to survive. You know, but the reality is, along the way, I've made some really great friends and had some great times and great experiences. And that's kind of where I am now, loving my work, loving my life, and moving forward on my journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's that song that says, I don't know if you've ever heard it, it's an old gospel song that says, I've had some good days, I've had some hills to climb, I've had some weary days and some sleepless nights, but when I look around and I think all things over, all of my good days have outweighed my bad, and that's where I am. It's on this journey, having a good time.
Fantastic. It's all about having the pluses more than the minuses in life. So that's wonderful. What are some of the major turning points in your life that led you to be the person you are today?
Well, you know, there have been many points, and sometimes when you're in the midst of those points, you don't realize how pivotal they are to your journey and how pivotal they will be to who you become and how you deal with things in the future. But when I look back, I look at several tough situations. I think the first was the illness and death of my paternal grandmother. Not so much that she and I were so close, but at that point, my dad kind of left home to care for his mom full time. So it very much imploded my sense of security. And that was kind of something that I think has shaped me to become more independent, perhaps, than I would have, or to be more clearly a little bit more self-reliant on some levels.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the illness and death of my maternal grandfather, who I absolutely adored. I swear I believed that he could walk on water. He was the most significant person in my life up till that point.
Mm-hmm.
So that really rocked me, and that really showed me that, you know, all things eventually are going to come to an end. So it's important to appreciate the people in your life and live every day for the best that you can. And then there are other things like divorce and becoming the single parent of what turned out to be a chronically ill child. And she went through some tough health challenges growing up and even recently.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a challenge. So that kind of makes you tough, and it makes you strong, and it makes you appreciative of who you have around you and your support system. And then I think one of the other turning points was that I was the victim of domestic violence and abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And before that happened, I never really understood many of my divorce clients, particularly women, but sometimes men as well, that would stay with an abusive spouse. And I just thought, well, that's ridiculous. Why would you do that? Just pack up, move, and move on. But I, being in that situation, being married to an abusive alcoholic person, it gave me a sense of empathy and the ability to really work with people and to understand that it's not that easy and that it does create challenge. So when I look at those times in my life, I think that those are among the most pivotal times. I think
mm-hmm.
there have been times that have definitely shaped me. Last year, one of my cousins, who I was very close to growing up, suffered a brain aneurysm and passed away. And she and I had been absolutely inseparable growing up and kind of took very different routes in life. But we stayed mm-hmm. relatively close in adulthood. But there were times when she would call, and you know what, I didn't take the time I should have or could have or I would have if I had known that that relationship was going to end. So I really started looking at life as it really is short and that you can't take anything or anyone for granted. And you can't put things off
mm-hmm.
until someday, because frankly, as they say, someday is not on the calendar. And you have to go with it. So at that point, I really shifted the focus of my work. I'm now working, in addition to doing mediations and divorce, I now work full-time as a college professor, which had been my lifelong dream. But pursuing it is something that I had really put off and waiting till someday when things were different. And so I knew it was time. It was time for a major shift in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that all of those times, and probably some others that I haven't thought about, have shaped who I am and given me a sense of grounding and a sense of the ability to dream and the ability to set goals.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that all those things have played into who I am.
Very interesting. I know in reading your book, there's a lot of you in it in terms of experience. I mean, you cannot write a book the way you wrote it in terms of just, you know, well, let me do some research and let me put it down on paper. I think there's a lot of merit in doing that, but at the same time that you have to sort of live the experience yourself and be an experiential writer in being able to put the things that you put in the book, and it makes a lot of sense. What inspired you in writing the series of books that you did?
Actually, exactly what you said. What inspired me is my life, my life, my friend's life, my family life, that all of these things of, oh my goodness, what do I do now? And the writing, really, I've always loved writing. I've always been a writer at heart and sometimes even in real life. It started as a real cathartic kind of way of getting through my mom moving into an assisted living facility and the dynamics of my parents aging. And then it kind of mushroomed into a research piece on how to navigate through that process of finding services and the logistics of getting them moved and healthcare and financial management for aging parents and all of those things. So all of that sort of integrated into questions of, well, what do you do when you're in situations? So the series just kind of grew out of that, as well as my friends going through and my clients going through divorce or dealing with a special needs child or all of those issues that you look at in your life and you say, oh, wow, how did I get here? But better yet, what do I do now?
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to produce some real step-by-step information for people on, well, here's what you do now. So that was really the inspiration for the What Now book series.
Very interesting. Now, I know in elderly planning, you have a wonderful way of laying everything out, but these are a few things that I figured that it's very important. I mean, certainly for me and I'm sure a lot of people. Number one is knowing when it is time to plan.
Yes. And I think you're best planning as soon as you think there is a potential of a problem,
mm-hmm.
not when there is a problem. For my brother and I, we thought probably 3 years prior to the onset of my parents really needing some services, we sat down with them and had the what-if talk, and we
mm-hmm.
spent a weekend talking about all of the what-ifs. What if you become disabled? What if you're unable to drive? What if, what if, what if, what if, including
mm-hmm.
right down to what if funeral plans. So because we talked about it in what ifs and not, well, what now or what is happening, we were able to come up with a guide of how we would handle things, which has proven us very helpful for us, because
mm-hmm.
when it was time for my mom to go into assisted living or when there were issues with my dad, we just went back to the plan and said, well, this is what we talked about. This is what we decided. Let's put it into action.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the best time to plan is the second you think that there is a reason to plan.
And it should be gradual, too. You don't have to come down to a crisis situation before it triggers something off. I mean, exactly what you were talking about in terms of maybe a slow, gradual process. And the reason I say this is I'm leading towards my next question would be dealing with resistance.
That is a huge problem. That's a huge problem for so many families, not only from the aging parent or relative, but also among siblings, that one sibling is not ready to face it or they have a real difference of opinion. So it does need to be gradual and it does need to be in a comfortable manner. And I always suggest sometimes it's easier when they're watching, like the parents are watching a situation. For example, if something is happening to one of their friends or one of their family members, you can easily say, wow, what would you do in that situation? Or what do you think of that? Or if there's a news story on, wow, I can't imagine if we were in that situation, how would you want us to handle it? So I think if it's as disarming as possible, that's
mm-hmm.
when it's workable.
Of course, no two rules apply to everyone. And one of the things that I saw that you address is the fact that in understanding the here and the now, we talk about multiple marriages here and the responsibility. You got, for lack of a better term, you have a lot of cook in the kitchen at the same time. How do you handle that?
And you know what? That's a great way of putting it. And I think that it, once again, you need to be inclusive as possible in terms of who's going to be involved in the conversation. And if there is a prior family or if there's another set of children, they need to be included. And discussions have to be had. And frankly, when a couple is entering a second, third, fourth marriage, elder planning, relationship between the children of both of them needs to be discussed. And that's even if they're going to be cohabitating.
Mm-hmm.
Whose family makes decisions or does the partner make decisions? So it's important to have those conversations. Nothing is worse, and I've had several cases where people are meeting their step siblings at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And we think about blended families with younger children, but very often we fail to think of blended families when we have adult children. Mm-hmm. That it is very important to do those kind of things, those bonding things, and so you do become a family. My daughter is out and about on her own at this point, but if I were to remarry, I would absolutely want to become a family and have her become very comfortable with my new family as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a piece that's very often left out, particularly when you have adult children. You don't necessarily think that they need to be part of.
Right.
And that's just not the case.
In 2010, the blended family in the United States supersedes the regular nuclear family.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so whatever you're talking about, it's far more important in years to come.
Absolutely. You have to do it. You have to become, if you're going to join together either in a long-term committed relationship or in a marriage, you have to become, you have to understand it's a blended family.
Mm-hmm.
So while you may not have the same issues you would have if it's a blended family with a 5 or 6-year-old, there are clearly going to be issues and potentially much more major issues when you're talking about end-of-life decisions and financial management of aging people.
Mm-hmm. Besides what I brought up, what are some of the other practical strategies that you think in elderly planning that's important for people to understand and make sure that they address those issues?
One of the things I think, first and foremost, is that most people, when they do a retirement plan, they do a retirement plan based on their health, their lifestyle, et cetera, pre-retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And people do estate planning on the other end, which comes into play after their death. But what about, and we're very much an aging population, what about the potential 10, 20, 30, 40 years between active retirement
mm-hmm.
and death? So the first thing is to really plan that time. How, once your finances change, how will you support yourself? If there's a health condition that's diagnosed later in life, how will that be addressed? So it's important to figure out where you are at retirement, how you'd like to be between active retirement and end-of-life decisions, and how you'll make end-of-life decisions will be made and finances will be handled. So it's really concentrating on that middle time, because we never know how long it's going to be. Some people obviously are active until the day they pass on and they're able to continue their own financial matters, et cetera. But there's a huge amount of the population who is not in that condition, that
mm-hmm.
needs some assistance on some level, even if it's just assistance with daily living. It's a need potentially for something. So you need to plan that time period and take the steps to do a concrete plan. I have not hit 50 yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I've already started having these conversations with my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want her to get in the position of feeling, oh, mom would never want to do this, or mom would want this, and I can't provide it. I want her to be able to be comfortable with whatever decisions have to be made.
Mm-hmm.
And you never know when those decisions will be made.
If you have to give 3 things, the most important things that a must do on the list, because your book is very comprehensive in terms of elderly planning, so what would be the 3 things, if nothing else, if people can't do everything, if there are 3 things that they need to do, what are the 3?
I think first and foremost, understand your available options. Become an educated consumer. What kind of options are available? Secondly, develop some level of a plan regarding payment of services, like everyday financial management, logistics, some outline of a plan. It doesn't have to be necessarily completely as detailed as the book workbook would provide, but an understanding. Develop a plan which includes an understanding of what will happen. And I think the most important thing is to maintain your family relationships, to not let care of an aging parent or illness of an aging parent or someone else in the family destroy the family relationships. Those relationships have been important probably up through your life. They will continue, hopefully, to be important and significant. Maintain the respect for both the parents and the family at large.
the biggest thing I think also is a challenge is the end of life medical wishes. That's mm-hmm. something that I know my mom and I have had this conversation before, because she has a problem with one of her kidneys, and she only has one kidney left, and she refused to go and get an operation for it because she feels like, hey, look, I'm 83 years old, and I feel like I've lived my life, and I don't want to go through the whole process. Now, given the opportunity, if I were to make the decision, obviously I want her to live to be 200. That's mm-hmm. not practical. And, of course, I have to honor her wishes in this case. So let's talk a little bit about that. What's your take on it?
I think that that's one of those conversations that has to be had, that there is always some kind of it's hard. Just as you would want them to live for 200, you don't. It would be difficult to be the person to make the decision to end their life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that you have to be honest with yourself, and you have to be the family needs to be honest with each other. If there's more than one child, if there are multiple siblings, who really should be making those decisions? How should those decisions be made? For my family, I am so emotional. I'm the emotional
mm-hmm.
one. If I got the call that I had to make a life and death decision for either of my parents, particularly my dad, I can't do it. I
mm-hmm.
just am not. I'm not there. My brother is very logical. He thinks more with his mind than he does with his heart.
Mm-hmm.
He can make those decisions logically. So we've agreed years ago that he needs to be the one to make that decision, because I'm not equipped to make that decision. And I know that. He knows that. But
mm-hmm.
I trust him enough when we've had the conversation with my parents as to what they would want, that I'm comfortable with him making those decisions
mm-hmm.
based on the realities of the decision, which is beyond my ability. So I think that it's so important to, A, get a clear understanding of how parents feel
mm-hmm.
or how the person feels, and B, to figure out how that desire will be executed. Who will make that decision? Who will sign the do not resuscitate order? Who makes the decision to terminate life support system? What life support systems are acceptable? Which ones are not? So you really need to have a very, very, very detailed discussion about that. That's where people, unfortunately, so many families fight. So many families say,
mm-hmm.
well, mom would never want us to terminate life support. Many of these families end up in court and having a judge decide, and then
right.
they never speak to each other again. Not
mm-hmm.
a good place to be. Have the
Very
conversation
true.
As hard as it is.
It's true, though, what you just said. And for my mom's situation, obviously, I honor what she wants to do. And my only take on that is, of course, this is with my sister's agreement. I just wanted to make sure that my mom is making a sound decision right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's all about. I think in honoring her is, mom, are you sure you're making an informed decision? Just to let you know. And that's important. And as she explained to me her take of it, then I understood that. And I want to make sure that she's not rushing in terms of making the wrong decision.
And I think the term that you've used, honor her decision,
mm-hmm.
is phenomenal, because that's what it comes down to,
mm-hmm.
that you want to honor what she would want. But I think it's incumbent upon parents to let their child know what they would want
mm-hmm.
so the child can feel that they're honoring their decision, because I think that's so important, that you want to feel that you're doing what she would want you to do or he would want you to do. So I think it's incumbent on parents to say to their child, this is where I am with this.
Right. Very true. Well, let's switch over to what now the planning, because this is another very, very interesting and touchy issue. How does your book help someone go through the challenging times in their life?
Well, I think very similar to the What Now Elder Planning. This book also has a workbook. This book also has a step-by-step guide on how to get through the emotional, financial, legal aspects of divorce, to develop a plan to figure out what you need, what you want, and how you're going to get there. And more importantly, how you will live the rest of your life, a plan for moving forward. So the book is very practical in terms of helping people to understand how to get from point A to point B.
One of the things that I quickly picked up on is knowing your rights and options. Tell us a little bit more about that, because I think that's the biggest fear that people have normally. And I would say most likely on the female side versus the male side in some situations, unless both are working and both knows exactly what the situation is and so forth. But majority of the time in a divorce situation, the wife, the women are very confused and frightened. And a lot of times it's because of that fear they kind of hang on to the marriage a lot longer than they should.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. I think that that's absolutely true, that people don't understand what their rights and responsibilities are. And every state is different. So if you live in Massachusetts and your sister got divorced in North Carolina, the way your divorce is going to turn out is very, very different than what happened to your sister in North Carolina. So people need to find out state-specific laws to understand what their overall rights are and, moreover, what their overall responsibilities are. And then I would also do some additional research that's not necessarily state-specific, but think about things like retirement and elder planning and child support and raising children, co-parenting. So do as much research, read anything and everything you can possibly read to understand what your rights and responsibilities are. One of the mistakes that people make, I see, is that the first thing they'll do when they decide to get divorced, they'll pick up the phone and they'll call a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But even though I'm a lawyer, I think that that is a huge mistake. I think that people aren't quite ready to call a lawyer, that they need to do some background work first, that they need to figure out where they are and what really is going on, and to get a general understanding of what you need and what you can get, to be practical and pragmatic. I look at it, you turned out that you needed some kind of medical treatment, you wouldn't jump on a surgeon's table before finding out what you need. You need to take your time, put your pieces together before you go see a lawyer. And that may mean seeing a financial person, a therapist, a life coach, whatever, but not jumping into the legal process immediately.
That's true. Even though each state has their own law, per se, in with regards to family law and everything else, but the very minimum is that they're pretty good in some ways, because you do have lots of rights. Now, although some states may have more bells and whistles here, I'm using just a layman's term, but to think that you don't have anything, that's ridiculous. Isn't that right?
True. To all states, people getting divorced do have certain rights and responsibilities. Absolutely, that is true. It's just a question of what are your rights and responsibilities. For example, if you're going to be the person paying child support, how is that determined and how is that calculated? Or if there's going to be an alimony, is it a state that has an automatic alimony based on certain things, or is it a state that a judge has complete discretion over whether or not alimony will be awarded? And I think the biggest difference is that there are some states that are what's known as community property states, that everything that's in the marriage in terms of financial assets and assets are community property and divided accordingly at the time of a divorce, where other states are equitable distribution states where some things are included within family assets, some things are not part of the marital assets, and how those things that are part of the marital asset are divided are by negotiation and or by a judge's decision. So it's important to know if you're in a community property state or if you are in an equitable distribution state and how that will play out and what the norm of your local courthouse is in terms of division of assets, alimony and child support, et cetera.
I'm glad you brought that up, because all it is that one is mandated and the other one is negotiable. In the end, it is still a fairly level playing field.
It's a very level playing field to some extent, depending mm-hmm. on what is deemed to be equitable. If mm-hmm. all things being equal, if the parties are making the same amount of money, if there mm-hmm. are enough assets to spread around, then it's generally, it is always an equitable division. But if there is a huge income disparity or huge asset disparity, judges or negotiations will take that into account.
That brings me to the next thing that you wrote in the book that I thought was very, very interesting. And you mentioned this several times about teamwork, choosing the right team to work for you. Tell us a little bit more about that.
I think that you need to go beyond just hiring a lawyer. You need to have an entire team of people who can help you get through the process. I remember once I went to my parents' house after I had done like a 4 or 5 day divorce trial, and I was so happy because I was able to get my client to her house, and she was just ecstatic. I was ecstatic, and I mentioned to my parents, oh my goodness, I was so thrilled I was able to get her the house. And my dad, a CPA, said, really? Well, what kind of encumbrances and tax liability is that for that? And I'm thinking, huh, I don't know. So I think it's important to get some input from
right.
someone who does know those answers.
Right.
So I've always tell my clients, let's talk to your CPA. If you don't have a CPA, let's hire one. Let's talk to your therapist mm-hmm. and figure out what you need. Let's talk. Go get a physical immediately mm-hmm. before you see a lawyer. Go get a physical, a pre-divorce physical is what I call it, so we can get some input from your doctor as to are there any underlying medical conditions that need to be looked at. Is there an mm-hmm. expectation of future medical problems? Let's get everything on the table as much as we possibly can.
I agree. I think the medical issue is a big thing, because the biggest issue is that, I mean, some states does it a lot better, but then again, doesn't the federal law require some sort of continuity with medical coverage, that is, for the spouses or ex-spouses?
Under the law, as it stands today, and this I'm sure is a moving target,
mm-hmm.
all states have some kind of COBRA benefits, meaning that you can make available the health benefits that were available through a former spouse's employer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's generally for a period of around 18 months. The problem with COBRA is that it's very expensive generally. So if you're going to take advantage of COBRA, you need to make sure that that is included in your financial budget. That if it's $600 a month and you're making $300 a month, you need to negotiate that cost in. Maybe it means that your former spouse pays it. Whatever it takes, you need to put that in. So healthcare is something that is obviously in this country a moving target,
mm-hmm.
but you need to take it into consideration when you are negotiating or when you are at trial.
Interesting. The reason why I brought this up is because the fact that, again, as I mentioned in the beginning of the divorce planning, a lot of people were taken aback in terms of, oh my gosh, I wish to get away from this relationship, but I can't because I'm not covered, or the fear, the thought of not being covered medical-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the end, they end up sticking it out, and all for the wrong reason, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think that's kind of the trend sometimes, that people mm-hmm. are staying together for healthcare or staying together for financial reasons. But
right.
you have to look at that on a couple of levels. You have to look at it as, does that really work for you?
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine asked me once when I was in the midst of deciding whether or not I was going to get out of my abusive relationship or
mm-hmm.
not. And she asked me very pointedly, well, how much of your life are you willing to dedicate to being in this situation? I think it's a great
mm-hmm.
question.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a very different answer than I'm staying in it for health care.
Right.
It's how much of your precious lifetime are you willing to dedicate?
Very interesting. What is the number one advice you can give to an individual contemplating on getting a divorce?
Wow. After 20 years of mediation, writing books, and blogging regularly, you want just one potential answer? Okay.
Call me. Okay, call me. Number is.
Absolutely. Come to me. I can do mediation for you in 2 hours and keep your fees down. But if I had to give one piece of advice, which is hard for me, I would say separate your emotional divorce from your legal divorce. They're two very different things, and they do not intersect and should not intersect. The legal divorce is a business transaction. The emotional divorce is what it takes for you to become whole again. A therapist is not prepared to help you get through the legal process, nor would you go to a therapist to get through the legal process. You wouldn't go to one of your friends to get through the legal process. So why would you depend on your lawyer to help you get through the emotional process? So the reality is separate out the two, deal with them very differently, deal with them separately. That would be my one piece of advice.
Fantastic advice. I think that's wonderful because there's all these two parts to the equation. And people don't realize that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
One of the things that is a growing trend is undivorced. Tell us what that is all about.
You know, I think that takes on a really interesting time. I think that given the current financial and economic condition of the country and of so many people, that many people are staying together for the reasons that you pointed out, that financially or for medical reasons they're unable to get out or they think that it's better to keep the family intact. So they are staying together, but no longer acting as a married couple.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, I think that that's one of those decisions that you have to really step back and say, is that really the best answer? Is it better for your children? Is it better for you? Are you the kind of person who needs to close a chapter of your life to be able to move forward into the next chapter? And if so, maintaining that quasi-marital relationship, does that allow you to do that? So I think it's one of those very personal things that it may be workable for some couples, from other people, it's just not workable. So it's one of those things that you kind of have to really look into yourself mm-hmm. and into your relationship and then look at your life dreams, life goals, life hopes to figure out, is this the right decision? And not necessarily, and I know this is hard, mm-hmm. not necessarily be driven strictly by finances, but think about all the other aspects that come into account as well.
And that's what you're talking about is, again, you don't want to be heavy on the emotional side and not on the legal side, or don't be just heavy on the legal side and not taking your own personal emotional well-being into the equation here.
Exactly. You have to do both. You have to look at both sides of it.
How can someone be their own life redefining and transition coach?
I'm not convinced that someone can actually completely take on that role for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because very often it's that you can't see the forest through the trees,
mm-hmm.
that we often see our lives in a vacuum, and that sometimes a second eye can certainly help to define things, to qualify things. But you can certainly be, and you should be, the captain of your ship.
Mm-hmm.
So you should be the one who's directing that. Life coaching is all about helping people get from the type that I do, is helping people get through situations and move on afterwards. So it's about setting goals, developing a plan to reach the goals, and then it's the accountability piece that's so important. The weekly phone call or the biweekly phone call or teleconference about how are you doing? Have you reached this goal? Did you apply for that job? Did you finish writing your resume? Whatever the goal happens to be. So mm-hmm. it's not to say that someone can't use a friend, but I think that to use a friend is also difficult because while I share very much with my friends, I can't depend on all of my friends to help me through certain things. For example, in the book, I talk about how many people have different kinds of friends. You have your cheerleader friends who will cheer you on no matter
mm-hmm.
what.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're using your cheerleader friend as your accountability coach, you may hear things like, "That's okay, you can do it next week." Or, "Okay, mm-hmm. but you had a hard time." That's not helping you get to your goal. It's making you feel good, but it's not helping you get to your goal. Then you have I have, and many people have, a friend, someone that you can just have a good time with, your shopping buddy, as I put it. That person also conceivably is not the right person. So I think using a friend can be difficult depending on the relationship. And sometimes we are less harsh on our friends because we don't want to hurt their feelings or hurt the friendship. So I'm all said done, I think that people should set goals but find a way to have accountability. And if you're the kind of person who can hold yourself accountable even when you're not necessarily 100% on your game, even when you're going through tough times, that would be workable. But if you're the kind of person who sometimes, and I think most of us are, frankly, who sometimes loses focus when you're trying to keep all the balls in the air and one is going stray and you're just trying to get it all done. So it's that focus point as well, the accountability and the focus that I think the coaching comes in.
Let's go back to the team effort, because you had mentioned that several times in the divorce planning aspects of it, of course, choosing the right team and so forth, and then now having all of them working in concert together. So let's talk about that. Let's break that down a little bit, and let's talk about who are the players on the team.
Well, who the players are is very individualized. But at the very least, I think that in the course of a divorce, the first player should be your physician, that you need to have your medical condition tested to figure out exactly where you are. Next, I believe that there's some type of a support system, your emotional support system, whether that is a therapist, a marriage and family therapist, or a psychologist, or someone, a clergy member, or a friend, and this is a great place for friends to come in. But who's your go-to emotional person? Who's going to help you with that stuff? Then I think you need asset valuators, whether it's a real estate agent or simply an asset valuator, to figure out what you have, is it worth anything, and what you should do. Also, some kind of financial person, either a CPA or a financial planner or a financial advisor, to help you figure out your financial needs, current and future. And if there are any past issues, clearing up past credit or tax issues that came about during the course of the marriage. And then also potentially a lawyer. On the other hand, if you're not necessarily going to use a lawyer, mediation is always an option. So then your mediator would be part of the joint team, sort of speak, of you and your potential former spouse. So depending on how you want to take your divorce, whether or not you want to go to the traditional litigation route or if you want to do something like mediation or collaboration, that would depend on who that last person is on the team.
What's interesting is that the attorney comes in as the last person on the team, because I think it's always quite the reverse.
It is. It really is.
No one would have thought about, well, I'm planning to get a divorce, I need to go see a doctor. I don't think so. I think a lot of times people will say, who knows a good divorce attorney, will be the first question that comes to mind.
Fortunately, and people then, and understandably, they get very concerned about the level of legal fees, how much they get to be.
Yeah.
But if I have to put together a spreadsheet for someone, if I have to do all of that as an attorney, the fees are going to go up. If you can get your legwork done, if you can get an understanding of your own case, you are much better equipped to A, keep your fees down, and B, like I said, be the captain of that ship.
Basically, what you're saying is that to compartmentalize the areas of expertise.
Yes, absolutely. You need all of those pieces put together.
Fascinating. Can you share with us some of the success stories from your clients?
You know, I think that I've had clients who have done well in the divorce process, but I think that the most successful stories that I have are when I'm able to help people to move on with their life. I think the best time is when I get a family in on elder planning and the family is all over the place in terms of what they think that their parent needs, and siblings are barely speaking to each other, and parents are upset. when I can get them and mediate with them or do an elder plan with them and they are then a family again, those are my biggest success stories. When I see an absolute outcome of workability. So I think that most of the time, if the mediation process works, either elder mediation or divorce mediation or post-divorce mediation, or if the planning works, that's the success. So more often than not, it's the family who comes in and mom has just had a stroke and the siblings are fighting. Having them walk out and have lunch together and able to then have a family, that's the biggest success. And that's where I count my successes, on the families mm-hmm. and the couples who are able to get divorced and then at the end of it still able to effectively co-parent. Mm-hmm. That they're both able to show up at the cheerleading competition or have the football team over or whatever it is, and everybody is comfortable. So it's a matter for me of getting through the process and living fully at the end.
Wonderful. What would you like to have your readers get from reading those books that you have written?
The biggest takeaway is how to come up with a way of keeping your family together, mm-hmm. of coming up with a workable solution to deal with family issues, and to achieve the best possible care and services available for whatever the issue is, whether it is advocating for a special needs child and getting the best possible educational opportunity, whether it's advocating for an ill parent, whatever the family issue is, coming up, knowing how to develop a way to get through it.
How has writing your books impacted you personally?
Well, like I said before, they have been cathartic. Mm-hmm. They have made me understand the process more from a logistical standpoint than I did before. And it gives me a greater sense that I can accomplish, that I can look at the situations using the workbooks and have people have real success of being able to show families that have stayed together or children whose lives have been impacted because their parents have or are able to effectively work together and they're happy. So it has impacted me because it has given me a real sense of accomplishment in terms of being able to help people.
Great. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
I think the best place is probably my website, which is lauriegiles.com, LaurieGiles.com. And the books are also available on Amazon. And also, I'm always open to doing mediations and planning long distance or going to wherever people are to help them get it done.
Great. So you're not bounded by just the laws of Connecticut, so to speak. You are basically available nationwide.
I'm available nationwide to do mediation and planning, but not to distribute legal advice. My legal advice is strictly in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's the last leg of the process, so to speak, because what you're wanting to do is to help them with the various initial aspects of the entire planning side of the equation.
Or putting with divorce mediation, if I was to do a mm-hmm. divorce mediation for a couple in New Jersey, while I wouldn't be put together the specific amount of child support, for example, I would certainly help them negotiate a settlement that they could then take to a court mm-hmm. and have part of the final be the final divorce.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Now, you also write for the Huffington Post. Tell us a little bit about that.
I do. I write for Huffington Post Divorce. Most of my articles are really step-by-step guides and dealing with specific issues. For example, how to get past impasse when you're trying to negotiate or choosing a lawyer or keeping lawyer fees down or choosing a mediator. So they're very practical pieces in the Huffington Post. I don't really get into opinion that much, although sometimes that's hard, but it's more of the logistical, practical, from a legal, emotional mediator standpoint.
What is the number one challenge that someone faces going through a divorce?
staying true to themselves. I think that not compromising what's important is one of the biggest challenges. And included in that, I would say also not being swayed by friends and family, mm-hmm. being able to be in a place to make strong, well-thought-out personal decisions, to maintain being practical, to maintain being reasonable in requests and demands. So really staying true to yourself and staying committed to what is what you in your heart believe is correct, as well as your head.
2011, what can we expect from you?
Wow, here we are. I've also started writing for Post-Divorce Chronicle, and mm-hmm. so I really am gaining quite an interest on the post-divorce side. So I think mm-hmm. there's potentially, at the end of 2011, potentially for at the beginning of 2012, there will be a book out on Suddenly Single, of the logistics of what happens after a marriage if you are single, what are the kinds of things you need to put in place. And I'll be taking a look, I believe, in that book as well about younger widows and widowers mm-hmm. and what happens if your spouse becomes ill and you're in your 40s or 50s and then passes away or becomes disabled. What does that look like and how do you get through that? So those are the two areas that I think will be coming out in 2011. There'll still be lots of stuff with the Huffington Post. And that's where I see this year going.
Fantastic. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
I think that my recipe for living is to maintain your priorities, to figure out what's important in your life and maintain that no matter what. So if your priority is family, don't let work come in front of it. I think that that's a mistake that I've made in my life, and I think that that's a mistake that so many people make, that if you are, you need to set priorities, set boundaries, and live by those priorities and boundaries.
Any special things that your mom had mentioned to you that, looking back in time, it doesn't make sense, then as you live your life as a mother, it makes a whole lot of sense?
Oh, so many things. Like why I can't date at 11. Well, when I had an 11-year-old daughter, I absolutely got it. So there have been those things of what I learned or what I wish I knew back then. I think that one of the things that my mom taught us, and I really did not appreciate it at the time, is I don't think that she ever really pushed my brother or I in a specific direction. She mm-hmm. was never very harsh about grades, et cetera. And her philosophy was that the child will come into their own. The child, as she would say, will come full circle mm-hmm. and live their best life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's something that I have learned subliminally, although I, at that point, couldn't understand it, that it's so important to let your child develop their own sense of self, to figure out what works for them, to give them the roots and wings, so to speak, the roots to be grounded and the wings to be able to feel like they can go out and conquer the world.
Mm-hmm.
But let them figure out what that looks like. And as long as it's not something dangerous, to be supportive but not be the dictator, to let them navigate through. I used to tell my daughter when she was a teenager, my mm-hmm. job as a mother of a teenager is to help her navigate through the shark-infested waters, that I'm standing on the other side saying, no, no, mm-hmm. To the left, to the right. And mm-hmm. as she put mm-hmm. it, and her job would then be to say, well, I will risk the bite
mm-hmm.
or I'll do it your way. So I think you have to develop that relationship that you can help them navigate from afar, but you mm-hmm. should not be in the water swimming with them.
Very interesting concept. How successful have you been with that?
You know, she has absolutely become her own person. She is absolutely doing and being led by what she believes is correct. And It's working. She's very spiritually grounded. She's able to figure out what she needs and how to navigate and get it done. And then she's strong enough and confident enough to ask for help, not just of me, but of her uncle or whomever, when she needs it, and to get advice. She doesn't feel that she can't talk to me or she can't talk to another older person.
Mm-hmm.
So it has worked. It has worked to let her stumble a little bit, to let her fall if need be, to figure out how to get back up and how to keep swimming.
Fantastic. Please share with us again your website address.
It's www.laurie.giles.com.
Thank you very much for being with me this morning and for sharing all the wonderful information that you have. The book is a must-read, I believe, for people that wants to plan for their future, whether in the situation of a divorce or especially planning for your elders, basically, your parents and so forth. I think it's just a tremendous workbook. It's very detailed, and that's what I like about it very much, and it's easy to follow, step-by-step plan. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us this morning. Please join me next Tuesday as we kick off our 2011 Mother's Day series. My guest will be Jacqueline Elderberg. She is a mother and the co-author of the book titled How to Walk to School. This is a true story about two moms who galvanize and organize an entire community to take part in a leap of faith, transforming a challenged urban school into one of Chicago's best virtually overnight by creating the blueprint for a neighborhood school renaissance. Jacqueline and I will be discussing about her life's journey and her work that has inspired other communities and their public school system. For additional information about this show, future shows, and to receive a free recipe for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. Laurie, thank you again, and have a great day.
Thank you. Have a great one.
Thank you. Bye-bye.